Last time we were talking about the huge diversity of functions that proteins perform in cells. Any individual protein has its own function. It's not that a protein has all of those functions. But proteins as a category of macromolecules has a huge variety of functions. And that makes sense because compared to the other macromolecule types, proteins can have just about any shape you want to imagine. And that allows them to take on so many functions. This is just one example in slide 16. This is an example of that first entry in the table we ended up with last time, which is as an enzyme. Enzymes are catalysts. And a catalyst is a substance that drastically speeds up a chemical reaction without actually being a reactant. So the catalyst doesn't get turned into something else like the reactant does. The catalyst helps the reactant turn into whatever it turns into in that reaction. And that's hugely important in biology because there are thousands of different chemical reactions that make up metabolism, which is life. And none of them basically would happen quickly enough in order to keep the organism alive. So effectively all of the chemical reactions occurring in organisms need to be catalyzed, sped up. And this is why a huge fraction of any given organism's set of possible proteins that they're able to make is devoted to being enzymes. Enzymes are proteins that act as catalysts in organisms. This is the general scheme. The purple thing here is the enzyme. It has a specific shape that allows it to fit a certain substrate, as it's called. That's just the name for the reactant in a catalyzed reaction. In this case, it's sucrose, table sugar. What's happening to sucrose here? What kind of reaction is this? Well, what's happening to the sucrose? Does anyone see this picture? What's happening to the sucrose?
It's connected to the enzyme.
Right, but what's happening to the sucrose eventually?
Is it hydrolyzed?
Right, it's a hydrolysis reaction, which is why water is required, right? Water is required to split something, some big thing, into two smaller things. That's just an example. Not all enzymes do that. The enzymes do all kinds of, catalyze all kinds of reactions. But notice that after that's performed, the enzyme is still there. It's reusable. That's why I say it's not a reactant. It doesn't get transformed into a product. It just helps reactants turn into products. Anyway, let's go on to 17 and talk about the building blocks of proteins. Remember that of the overall four categories of macromolecules, three of them are polymers. What are the polymer ones? Which ones are polymers? Polypeptides, which is what we're focusing on right now. Proteins are polypeptides. What are the other two? Right. Polysaccharides are polymers made out of monomers called monosaccharides, right? You hook them together. Polynucleotides we'll get to after this, which are polymers made by hooking together nucleotides as monomers. Well, the monomers of polypeptides, you might guess, are peptides, but according to the word, but actually that's not true. The polypeptide is named for not the monomers, but the bonds between those monomers. The monomers are called amino acids, the single subunits. And that's what we're looking at in 17, the general scheme for an amino acid. There's no limit to the number of amino acids that can be built if you're making these in a laboratory. And that's because of what you see here as R. R is not a chemical, right? There's no chemical symbol for R. R meant what in functional groups?
Residue.
The residue. In other words, the rest of the molecule. The same thing here. All the rest of these, though, are definite atoms. So if you have exactly this scheme, a central carbon that is connected to a carboxyl, hopefully even without looking at the label, you recognize this as a carboxyl group. A hydrogen is also connected to that central carbon. An amino group is connected to the carbon. As long as all that's in place, then whatever is occupying that fourth position, you have an amino acid. And the simplest possibility, therefore, would be just to have a single hydrogen atom as your R group. But it could be anything else, not even any single atom. It can be groups of atoms. And that's why there's no limit to the number of possible amino acids. But biology books will usually say that there are 20 amino acids. That's not true. There's an unlimited number. What it should say is that there are 20 biological amino acids, because all organisms, not just now, but always throughout the history of life, use the same set of 20 amino acids to build their proteins. And this, by the way, this fact that organisms share these 20 is one of the most convincing pieces of evidence pointing to the fact that we all descended from that originally successful lineage of cells that I keep talking about, the trunk of the tree of life. We're all descendants from that. But all of that has to be in place for something to be considered an amino acid. Let's look, therefore, in slide 18 at the 20 biological amino acids. These are the ones that organisms use. And first of all, notice that all of the lavender background parts of these structural formula is the same on every one. That's the part that has to be in place for it to be an amino acid. Carboxyl, hydrogen, amino, all connected to a carbon, and then something else. The R group is the white highlighted part in each of these, and that's the only reason why there are different kinds of amino acids. It's the only thing that differs between amino acids is that R group. Well, these are the 20 overall that organisms use, but we can group them into categories based on the chemical properties of that R group, whatever it is. So this top group is the nonpolar group. You see a lot of hydrocarbons as R groups. Carbon and hydrogen have roughly equal electronegativities, which is why hydrocarbons in general are nonpolar. They equally share their electrons. And nonpolar things like to be around other nonpolar things. They don't like to be around polar things. So that affects how this group of amino acids is going to want to interact with other amino acids with different properties on their R groups. So you have the nonpolar group. You also have a polar group. That, notice, involves a lot of OHs. OH makes things polar because oxygen hogs those electrons. It has a much higher electronegativity than hydrogen. So just like water is polar, anything with an OH is going to be polar as well. And then even beyond polar, remember polar means there's a partial charge because there's unequal sharing. Beyond that is having a full charge because of ionization. So there are some amino acids that have ions as their R groups, and that makes them beyond polar. And you could actually subdivide the electrically charged group into two subcategories based on whether it's a negative charge or a positive charge. The negatively charged R groups give it an acidic property. The positively charged R groups give it a basic or alkaline property. All of this matters because shape is everything in a protein. And what did I say is another name for the shape of a protein? You're going to need to know these things if you want to pass the test. Another name for the shape of a protein is its conformation. Whatever the function is for any individual protein, it has that specific function because of its specific shape. And if it doesn't have that shape, it won't be able to function. Well, the reason that these R groups are so important is that when you put a bunch of amino acids together, as we're just about to look at, the string of amino acids is going to fold up into some specific three-dimensional shape. And it's going to attain that shape based on how the R groups of amino acids in that string want to be around each other or not. So let's talk about the building of a polypeptide. I said that the word polypeptide isn't named for the monomers, because the monomers are not called peptides. The monomers are called amino acids. But when you link two amino acids together, the name of that bond is a peptide bond. And when you link a bunch of amino acids together, you therefore have a bunch of peptide bonds, and that's why the overall thing is called a polypeptide. Now, this is done the old familiar way. What kind of reaction leads to building bigger things out of smaller pieces? What is it? Yes, but I mean, what did we talked about two kinds of reactions that are important for either building things up or breaking things down.
Dehydration.
Right. Dehydration is the name for the general reaction in which two pieces get together to form a bigger piece, and one of those pieces loses an OH, the other one loses an H, and that's why water comes out, right? H and OH become water that comes out of the situation. That's why it's dehydration. And that allows you to link the two together. So that's the same as what we've talked about when we hook monosaccharides together, for instance. That was dehydration. But we gave that a specific name, we gave the bond that results a specific name. What was that name for the bond between two monosaccharides hooked together? The disaccharide is what the whole chemical would be. I'm talking about the name of the bond. Glycosidic linkage, yes. A glycosidic linkage is formed between two monosaccharides using a dehydration reaction. What about the name for the bond between a fatty acid and the glycerol in a fat? That's called an ester linkage. And so there's three of those in a triglyceride or a fat, also formed by dehydration reaction. Well, now we're using a dehydration reaction again, but the things we're hooking together is different. It's amino acids that is being hooked together. So the name of the bond is different, and that's what peptide bond refers to. Okay, now remember when we talked about building polysaccharides, which is hooking together monosaccharides, right? I said at the time that a monosaccharide has several different OHs. That same ringed form of the monosaccharide has several different OHs, which are the connection points if you want to hook another monosaccharide to it. So you could already have a monosaccharide hooked to the first one, and you could hook another one to that first one at a different OH place. This is why polysaccharides can branch, because there's multiple hookup points. Well, that's not true for polypeptides. And that's because there's only one way to hook two amino acids together to form a peptide bond. To form a peptide bond, you have to hook the amino group of one amino acid to the carboxyl group of the other amino acid. And so there's only one way to do that, since each amino acid contains only one carboxyl and one amino. And you see that right here. This has already been connected, but before the connection point, this would have been the amino group, and this would have been the carboxyl group. All right. So we can see them intact here. This is the carboxyl. This is the amino of the next one. The carboxyl is going to lose an OH. The amino is going to lose an H. That comes out as water, and it allows the carbon and the nitrogen to be covalently bonded together, hooking the two amino acids together. And now, instead of it being what would be called a dipeptide, it's now a tripeptide. It's not a polypeptide yet, because poly means many, so you'd have to continue this process until it has enough amino acids to qualify as a polypeptide. But that's true of any polypeptide. It's built one amino acid at a time, hooking them all together end to end. There is no branching for a polypeptide, because there's only one way to make this hookup. Okay? Now, another important thing to say about this resulting polypeptide, this is really just a tripeptide, but imagine that it's longer. But actually, it doesn't matter how long it is. The important point here is that the only thing holding this together, however long it is, along its length, are the carboxyl and amino groups being bonded by peptide bonds. That forms the so-called backbone. And the carboxyl and the amino and the hydrogen group, I mean, these three things connected to the carbon, are the same for all amino acids. In other words, what's holding it together does not at all involve the part of the amino acid that makes it different from the other amino acids, which is the R groups. The backbone holds it together, and each R group is just hanging off of that chain. The R group is not at all involved in keeping this together. Do you see that? And so all of the R groups combined make up what are called the side chains. Now, they are really important, but not for holding it together. They're not involved at all in holding it together. They are important when it comes time, once you build this more or less string of beads, where the amino acids are the beads, they become important when you, after having built it, fold it up in a certain way to give it its shape, which is going to give it its function. And that's because that's going to bring R groups from non-adjacent, meaning amino acids that are not next to each other, close to each other. The R groups are going to be close to each other, and they're going to either want to interact or not want to interact based on the group they're in, polar, nonpolar, so on. So the side chains, the R groups, are important for giving eventually the completed polypeptide, once it's built, its final shape, which will give it its function. 20 shows you a little bit about the importance of shape. Now, this is just one example. This specific example is lysozyme, which is a certain kind of enzyme. It doesn't really matter. Any given protein or polypeptide has to have the correct shape if it's going to function. This one functions as an enzyme, so it has to have a specifically shaped groove here that we call the active site, that whatever the substrate is, the reactant that it helps turn into product, can fit in there. But so shape is, like I say, everything for the function of a protein. But there's two ways this same protein is being depicted, as a ribbon model and as a space-filling model. The space-filling model shows you individual atoms, and it's nice that we can computer-generate those, but it's not really how atoms look. But it gives you a sense of the three-dimensionality of it. I prefer the ribbon model, though, because even though it's not of the truth either, it doesn't look anything like a ribbon, really, the ribbon model is good because it reminds you of what I just told you earlier. A polypeptide does not branch, just like a ribbon doesn't. A ribbon has two ends, right? And if you make a ribbon out of little pieces, they're all end-to-end arranged. So this one purple ribbon here represents one polypeptide. However many amino acids are used to make it depends on the polypeptide, but any given polypeptide is one end-to-end arrangement of amino acids without any branching. We'll talk about those yellow things in a minute, which aren't really important to the point of that slide. Okay, 21 shows you another rendition of, there's actually two proteins here from two different entities, an antibody protein from an animal, like a human, for instance, and a protein from a flu virus. A virus is not an organism, but it's still a protein from this virus. And this shows you the importance of shape again. The reason antibodies work is because they have just the right shape to be able to fit a specific protein from something that could hurt you, something that's not part of you. This is how immunity works, right? When you get a vaccination, it spurs the body into producing just the right kinds of antibodies to recognize, for instance, coronavirus. And when it does recognize it, it says, okay, we need to do something to destroy this thing, and that's what keeps you from getting the disease. Now, in 22, I want to talk about four levels of protein structure. And this is when I can finally talk about the fact that I mentioned in a previous lecture that the words protein and polypeptide don't always mean the same thing. Now I can tell you why that's true. But first, let's just list the levels. They are just numerical levels. Primary means first, secondary, tertiary means third, quaternary, fourth. So those are the names of the levels of structure. Now, every single protein features at least the first three of these levels. And that's because every single polypeptide, one ribbon, features all three of these, at least. I mean, well, all three of these is true for any single polypeptide. Only some proteins also, in addition to those three, feature the quaternary structure. But I'll explain that when we get to there. Let's start, though, at primary structure. Primary structure refers to the specific sequence of amino acids that make up one polypeptide. Now, polypeptides vary in their length, so part of primary structure is how many amino acids there are, but the other part of primary structure is which specific one of the 20 amino acids occupies each position. Now, these are abbreviations for the 20 biological amino acids, so glycine, proline, threonine, and so on. You don't have to memorize those abbreviations, but that's what that's referring to. Okay, each one of these purple beads is one amino acid. And a polypeptide is like a string of beads, non-branching string of beads. That's the primary structure. That primary structure is what the cell has to be told how to make, which is why even though there is no limit to the number of proteins that can be built, you are only ever going to be able to build a certain set of proteins because your cells have to be told how to make each string. And what is it that tells your cells how to make each string of beads?
DNA?
Yes, that's what a gene is. A gene is a set of instructions for indirectly how to build one polypeptide. Okay, now that's primary structure, and there is no real shape to it yet. But the higher levels of structure that we're about to look at, all three of these, if they exist, at least two, but maybe three, those all depend on primary structure. They're all a consequence of primary structure, which is why it's so important to get this exact sequence right. Secondary structure is not yet overall three-dimensional shape either. But secondary structure refers to whether or not a polypeptide features either or both of these recurring patterns that occur some in a lot of proteins, but not all of them. One recurring pattern is a so-called beta-pleated sheet. It's like folds of an accordion. And that gives that part of the overall polypeptide a certain shape, but it's not the whole polypeptide. The other major repeating pattern is the alpha helix. A helix is a corkscrew shape. And so you see this in many proteins. So whether or not either of these is there, and if so, how many and where they are, makes up secondary structure, which is really just part of the shape of the overall polypeptide. Tertiary structure refers to the overall three-dimensional shape of one polypeptide. And that's why you can see here that the secondary structure is just part of this tertiary structure here. The tertiary structure, though, is the overall shape of that entire ribbon, that entire polypeptide. Okay, now, some proteins are made of just one polypeptide. That one polypeptide is the entire protein. In a lot of cases. In those cases, then the word polypeptide and protein are interchangeable in that context because they're referring to the same thing. The protein is, in that case, nothing more than the polypeptide. But there are other proteins that are more complex than that. And they are called multimeric proteins. Now, notice that multimer really is just another word that means the same as polymer. Mer means part, multi means many, poly means many. So both multimer and polymer mean multi-part. But polymer is already used, right? Because one ribbon, one polypeptide, is already a polymer. Well, some proteins, these multimeric proteins, are made of at least two and maybe more polypeptides that are then complex together somehow. And that's why if you have a multimeric protein, and it therefore by definition consists of more than one polypeptide, then the words polypeptide and protein are not referring to the same thing anymore. In that case, polypeptide is just one part of the protein. Also, importantly, when a multimeric protein is built, it's not the case that you're taking however many polypeptides there are and hooking them end to end. That would just make a longer polypeptide, right? It would still be back to one polypeptide if you hooked the ribbons end to end. That's not what's happening. In a multimeric protein, each, however many there are, each polypeptide remains a complete molecule with two ends. Each ribbon is still a distinct ribbon. And so what holds the ribbons together, what holds the polypeptides together in a multimeric protein is other forces. It doesn't make it one molecule. In essence, a multimeric protein, not in essence, it's true that a multimeric protein, even though we call it one protein, is actually multiple molecules because each polypeptide is a complete molecule in its own right. All right? Well, whatever the overall shape and arrangement of the constituent polypeptides that make up that multimeric protein is, that's what we call quaternary structure. The overall shape of the entire complex of polypeptides. And that applies only to multimeric proteins because only multimeric proteins have more than one polypeptide. This one, it looks like there's four individual polypeptides complex together. And the way they come together is that protein's quaternary quaternary structure. And one thing I should say also is that when you have a multimeric protein, you have to have at least two, but it could be any other number above one of polypeptides. Well, they can be just copies of the same polypeptide, or they can be different kinds of polypeptide. It just depends on the individual protein. Now, in 23, we're looking at least part of a polypeptide here, and the backbone of the polypeptide is represented by the ribbon. That's the non-variable parts of the amino acids, right? Ones that are the parts that are the same in every amino acid form the backbone. And then hanging off of that are the R groups. But you see a specific shape being formed here because of interactions between R groups that aren't next to each other in the chain, but because you're bending the chain, get brought into close proximity to each other. That's what determines the overall shape, the R groups hanging off and their interactions. So you see four major kinds of interactions here, even though there's, for some reason that I never understood, only three colors being used. They had plenty of other colors to choose from. These two blues are separate things. But anyway, let's look at this first upper left blue. One possibility for interactions between R groups in a polypeptide is hydrogen bonding, which is just like the hydrogen bonding we've already talked about, you know, between water molecules, for instance. If an R group contains a hydroxyl, for instance, and another R group of the other amino acid contains a carbonyl, then there's going to be partial charges on the oxygen and on that hydrogen, right? And therefore, they are going to have hydrogen bonding possible between them, just like two water molecules do. That's not a chemical bond. It's weak, but it's stronger than nothing. And therefore, it contributes to the stabilization of the overall polypeptide in that particular shape because of that affinity of those R groups for each other. Even weaker than that, but still more than nothing, are what we call hydrophobic interactions. Notice that these two R groups contain, well, what are these functional groups? You tell me. What are these four functional groups? You're not allowed to forget this stuff after you take the exam. You're supposed to learn. You're supposed to remember it for life. CH3 is what kind of chemical? I mean, what structural formula? It's the methyl group, right? Just like methane, if you had a fourth hydrogen, that's why it's called a methyl. Methyl groups, how would you describe them as far as what they're made out of? Right. They are hydrocarbon functional groups because it's nothing but carbon and hydrogen. And as I keep saying, hydrocarbons in general are nonpolar, right? Because of that equal sharing between carbon and hydrogen. So since they're nonpolar, each of these methyls, you would expect them not to have any attraction to each other, right? So why do they? Well, let me try to explain it with just a single CH on one piece and a single CH on the other piece. Each of these CH bonds is nonpolar, which means there's equal sharing. But at any given point in time, if you pause the clock, the two electrons that are being shared by the C and the H are somewhere, of course. Well, let's say they are up here on the C at the moment, and that on the other CH bond in the other amino acid, they are up here on the H, just for that point in time. Well, that is going to make this hydrogen slightly negative and this hydrogen slightly positive, right? So if they happen to be in these positions, that would cause a slight attraction there. And if the movement of these as they go between carbon and hydrogen is synchronized so that they're doing this basically, then there's always going to be an attraction there. What's going to change is this hydrogen is going to go from negative to positive and back to negative over and over. This one's going to be doing just the opposite. But they're always going to be slightly attracted to each other. Do you see that? And that actually does happen. So there is what is called hydrophobic interactions. Even weaker than a hydrogen bond, but still positive. I mean, still greater than zero. So if you have a lot of these, it can really have an effect. This, by the way, is why a gecko, for instance, is able to walk on glass upside down, because of hydrophobic interactions between its feet and the glass. It defies gravity because they're tiny forces, but there's a lot of them on the foot of a gecko, so they add up. All right, the strongest of these four by far is what's shown in yellow, and that's the same yellow that you saw in that previous slide. Those yellow bars were examples of this. It's called a disulfide bridge. Disulfide meaning that there's going to be two sulfurs involved. Well, if you look at that list of 20 biological amino acids, you'll see that there one of those 20 has, as its R group, it features a sulfhydryl group. Do you remember the sulfhydryl functional group? What is the sulfhydryl? It's an SH. Instead of an OH, it's like a hydroxyl, but it's SH. So this was SH for this R group. And this was SH for this R group. But when it bends and these two get close to each other, each sulfhydryl will lose its hydrogen. Think of this in molecular modeling terms. That means if you take a hydrogen out, you have a hole in it, right? You have a hole in the other one because you take its hydrogen out, and therefore you can bond them together, the two sulfurs, with a wooden peg between them. That's what this bond is. So this is a chemical bond, a covalent bond, which is much stronger than these other, and that really stabilizes the shape if it occurs. It doesn't happen in every polypeptide. It's more likely to happen the more sulfhydryl-containing amino acids happen to be in that polypeptide. And that really gives it strength and constancy of shape. You have a lot of these, for instance, in your hair, which is strong stuff. But that's also why if you burn hair, it smells like sulfur because of all those sulfur-containing amino acids in there. Oh, I didn't go over the other blue, which should have been another color. This is an ionic bond, which is also a chemical bond, right? So it's stronger than these top two, not as strong as the disulfide bridge. But this happens for the same reason that salts form. Right, a sodium ion, which we used as an example for sodium chloride, is positively charged. A chloride ion is negatively charged, and that makes them attracted to each other. Well, some of those R groups, remember on that bottom group of amino acids, those were electrically charged. They were ionized R groups. So if you get a positive ionized group next to a negative one, they are going to form an ionic bond, just like salts form. 24 uses two specific examples that don't really matter here. Collagen and hemoglobin are example proteins, but the point here is not those examples. The point is that when it comes to shape of proteins, you can lump any given protein into either of two categories based on shape. And collagen is an example of the first category, which is fibrous proteins. They're like fibers. In other words, they're long in one direction. And they function just like you would think fibers function, like little ropes, right? They're strong. They stand up to being stretched. They have tensile strength, in other words. And that's what collagen is. Collagen is a major component of your hair, but also your skin. So animals make a lot of collagen. Notice, by the way, that collagen happens to be a multimeric protein, because there's three individual polypeptides that make it up. But they remain individual polypeptides that are then complexed together by non-chemical bonds. Okay, so that's fibrous proteins. The other category, which hemoglobin is an example of, is globular proteins. Globular simply means that it's compact form. It's not long in any one direction. It's like a glob. Not necessarily a perfect sphere, but just compact. And a lot of proteins are like this, including enzymes in general, for instance, like the enzyme you saw in that cartoon a few slides ago. Hemoglobin's another example. It's also an example of a multimeric protein, by the way. Notice that there are four polypeptides here. Two identical copies of one type and two identical copies of the other type, four overall, make it a multimeric protein. And by the way, you have billions of red blood cells in your body. Each one is invisible, but there are billions in your, many, many billions in your body. Well, each one contains millions of hemoglobin molecules. And each individual hemoglobin molecule can carry up to four oxygen atoms, which is its major function, because of these four subunits, each containing a place where oxygen combined. Well, we're using hemoglobin as an example in 25 of another important point. Actually, it's not another important point. I've already told you the point about shape being everything, shape determining function, and therefore if the shape isn't right, the function is lost. Well, here we can see how drastic a change in shape can occur even with a tiny change in primary structure. Primary structure, remember, is the specific sequence of amino acids. So we're not looking at the whole sequence here. This is just the first seven amino acids it could, I don't remember how many there are, but it's much more than seven. In one of the two types of subunits that get complex together to form one hemoglobin molecule, or one hemoglobin. And valine, histidine, leucine, threonine, and so on, that's the so-called normal sequence. But what that means is that people that have that normal sequence have normally shaped, healthy, functioning hemoglobin. All right? It's not just these first seven, all the rest of them are correct as well. Well, on the right-hand side, we see that this version is from a person with sickle cell disease. But it's almost perfect as far as the sequence is concerned. The entire sequence, one through whatever, is correct, except the sixth amino acid, which instead of being glutamic acid, like in a normal human, it's valine instead. The rest of it is exactly correct. But that one difference with its one different R group is going to make it fold up into three-dimensional shape differently, and therefore it's not going to function the same as normal hemoglobin. It's misshapen, which first of all makes it less able to carry oxygen, its major function. But also the fact that it's misshapen means that copies of hemoglobin, each of which is misshapen, start interacting with each other and clumping together, which has the effect of misshaping the entire cell, the red blood cell that contains them. This is why it's called sickle cell disease, because instead of it being a biconcave disc, which is normal red blood cell looks like, it's sickle-shaped. This, though, shows you why primary structure is so important. You have to get that sequence right, which involves reading the gene in order to make that sequence. Otherwise, it's not going to function properly. Okay, more about shape in 26, or conformation. Remember, the conformation refers to a protein shape. You have the normal protein here. This polypeptide has a specific shape to do something, whatever it is. But even though the primary structure, that sequence, determines the shape, like I said, that's not the only thing that affects the shape. You have to get the sequence right if you want to have the right shape. But also, once it's built and has the right shape, if conditions in the environment change, the shape can change. And there's all kinds of environmental variables. But two really important ones that particularly can affect protein shape or conformation are temperature and pH. We talked about this when I was mentioning acid rain, right? pH changes, a change in pH changes protein shapes and they stop functioning. Well, whatever the variable is that causes a change in shape, that shape change is called denaturation. It's losing its proper shape if the polypeptide is being denatured. And there are different degrees of denaturation. If it's just slightly denatured, it might still function, just not as well. But if it's drastic enough, it will be not only a total loss of function, but it will be permanent. If it's not too drastic, then as long as you restore conditions to their normal values, it might renature and go back into its original proper shape. But once you get it too far gone, that's the end for that particular polypeptide, and the cell would have to build a new copy of it, which it can do because it still has the DNA library for how to build new ones, right? But if you think about this in real-world examples, cooking is a good example of this, right? We use meat, for instance, which has a lot of protein in it. You know, I'm sure, that a cooked steak is quite different from a raw steak. That change in texture is because of denaturation of those proteins when you change the temperature. And in that case, it's permanent denaturation, right? You can't decide you didn't want the steak after you cooked it. You can't put it back in the refrigerator. It's not going to go back into a raw steak, because it's permanent denaturation. And notice also that you can have kind of the same effect with raw fish if you squirt them with lemon juice. which doesn't change the temperature, but it changes the pH. It gives it kind of a cooked texture just because of changing the pH. In 27, we have the situation in which some proteins are helping other proteins attain their shape. Now, a lot of proteins, when they're first built, one amino acid at a time, will fold up properly into whatever their shape should be right there in the cell. The conditions in the cell are proper for it to take on the right shape. But it's not true for all proteins. Some proteins need help. They need to be isolated away from the rest of the cell environment so that they can get that right shape. And that involves a different protein called a chaperone protein, which is shaped more or less like a little canister, hollow canister, into which this new polypeptide that hasn't folded up yet can be put so that it's away from the rest of the cell, and it will then attain its proper shape and be ejected. So the chaperone protein is allowing a different protein to take on its proper conformation. Twenty-eight is a transition slide in a sense, because this serves as both the end of the protein section of the chapter, but also the beginning of the section of this slideshow covering the only one of the four categories we haven't covered yet. What is that? What's this fourth one that we haven't studied yet?
Lipids?
No, we did lipids. That was cholesterol and everything, right? Phospholipids and polynucleotides, which are nucleic acids. So this is the end of the proteins and the beginning of the polynucleotides, but the reason it's shown here together is to show you this correspondence between the two. And this is what I've been talking about when we've been talking about DNA determining protein. So this happens to use a eukaryotic cell as an example, which is why you have a nucleus, but the same would be true of a prokaryotic cell, it just wouldn't have the nucleus. The point here is that you have information contained in DNA, which is a nucleic acid made out of polynucleotides. That's a gene is part of a polynucleotide. That information is used by the cell to tell the cell how to build another version of a nucleic acid, which is RNA. DNA is deoxyribonucleic acid. RNA is ribonucleic acid. And essentially what DNA is doing is handing off the job of serving as a code to a different molecule. It tells the cell how to make this red thing, and now that red thing is carrying the code for how to build a protein, a polypeptide. And that's called messenger RNA, mRNA. And that mRNA, in order to be that code to be read by the cell and used to assemble the polypeptide, requires a molecular machine called a ribosome, this thing in brown. It will, one subunit at a time, which are in the subunits for nucleic acids are nucleotides, it will read, I shouldn't say one at a time, one codon at a time, we'll get into that detail later, but it reads the code one symbol at a time, basically, and that will tell the ribosome which particular one of the 20 amino acids to add next. You know, it's like stringing together beads. You have a big set of beads. There's 20 different kinds of beads. Those are the amino acids. And each time that you add one to the elongating string of beads, you can choose any one of the 20. Well, the information in messenger RNA, which comes from the information in DNA originally, tells the ribosome which bead to pick. And it also tells it when it's done. You've added the last one, now it's done. And that's the polypeptide that results. This is why you are stuck with the ability to make only certain kinds of polypeptides, because you can't form a polypeptide without instructions for how to do that. And that comes from your genes. Okay. Now we are fully in the polynucleotide part of the chapter in 29, and we can see a polynucleotide on the left. Now this is an extraordinarily short polynucleotide. It's only four subunits long. One DNA which is just one chromosome's worth, and each cell has 46 chromosomes, and you have trillions of cells, but just one DNA by itself is millions of nucleotides long. So this is very short for a polynucleotide, but it is a polynucleotide because it is many nucleotides hooked together. That's what the word comes from. So this is a polymer just like a polysaccharide is and just like a polypeptide is. The difference is what the subunits are, what the monomers are. The monomers are called nucleotides. There's four of them here, but notice we're taking a look at just one of these in the middle. So this is a nucleotide in the middle. That's not a polynucleotide. That's a single nucleotide, but it is a nucleic acid still. Nucleic acid doesn't really necessarily mean big or small. It just means the stuff you're talking about. Kind of like carbohydrate doesn't mean big or small, right? Monosaccharides are carbohydrates just like polysaccharides are. By the way, where did that phrase come from? Why do we call them nucleic acids? What does that mean? Just based on the word, what does it seem like to you?
Nucleus?
Right. We discovered nucleic acid in the nucleus of a eukaryotic cell. Even though prokaryotic cells have it for the same reason, we call it nucleic acid for that reason. All right, now, a nucleotide, a single nucleotide, one subunit, even though it is one subunit of the polymer, that one subunit itself has three components, as we can see here. One of those three components is a pentose. Now, what does pentose tell you? Two things. What does the OSE ending tell you? What's OSE ending mean? Like in glucose or fructose or galactose. What are those things? Yes, it's a sugar. OSE is some sort of sugar. And what does pent mean? Five. So a pentose is not a specific substance. It's a category of sugars, category of monosaccharides. Specifically, pentoses are five-carbon sugars. There's multiple different pentoses, just like there are multiple different hexoses. We saw that in that one slide we looked at earlier in this slideshow. But even though there are more than two different kinds of pentose, for nucleic acids made by organisms in cells, there are two choices. And those are shown in the lower right here. Each of these is a pentose, but this particular one in blue is deoxyribose. This one is ribose. Remember I said that DNA, one type of nucleic acid, is short for deoxyribonucleic acid. That's because however long that polynucleotide of DNA is, however many nucleotides make it up, hooked together end to end, every one of those nucleotides will have specifically deoxyribose as the sugar component. So each of these green ones is the same for however long. You don't mix and match sugars, in other words. If instead of making a DNA, though, you're making an RNA, then every one of the sugars for each nucleotide is going to be ribose instead. And therefore, the overall polynucleotide is a ribonucleic acid. Now, look at the structural formulae between the two. They're almost identical. What is the only difference? Yes, this position is called the 2' position because this is the first carbon, this is the second, third, fourth, and fifth. So connected to that second carbon is an OH here in ribose. But at the same position in deoxyribose, you have just an H. There isn't the oxygen, in other words, which means deoxyribose is ribose without that one oxygen. It's ribose with oxygen removed, and that's exactly what deoxy means. Ribose with oxygen removed. All right? Not a big difference as far as structural formula is concerned, but it determines the two major categories of nucleic acid. Okay, so you don't make a polynucleotide with nucleotides containing both, with some nucleotides being deoxyribose and some being ribose. It's either all deoxyribose or all ribose. And therefore, for any given nucleic acid, the sugar is not a variable component, right? It's going to be either deoxyribose if you're building DNA, or ribose if you're building RNA for all of the nucleotides. No variability there. The second component of a nucleotide is the phosphate group that you see here. At least one phosphate group. This one has one. Well, phosphate groups are phosphate groups. There's no variability there either. But the phosphate group is a necessary component to make this thing a nucleotide. And it's connected to the sugar at one position. The third component, then, is also connected to the sugar, but in a different place. And that third component is some sort of nitrogenous base. Nitrogenous just means nitrogen-containing. So this is the variable part of the nucleotide. Like the R group is the variable part of an amino acid, the nitrogenous base is the variable part of a nucleotide. That's the only reason that there are different kinds of nucleotides. Because the sugar is always the same within a DNA, and the phosphate's always the same. Okay? Well, we can see that there are five major nitrogenous bases. There are others as well, but they're not normally used. Five normal nitrogenous base choices, but DNA uses only four of those, so there's four real choices for DNA, and RNA uses only four. They're not the same set of four, though. So you have cytosine, thymine, uracil, adenine, and guanine, as you see here. Well, DNA uses cytosine, thymine, adenine, and guanine. That's the A, C, T, and G that you see over and over when DNA is depicted as a pattern of letters. RNA uses adenine, guanine, and cytosine also, but instead of thymine, it uses uracil. So what this means is that for an RNA, however big you make it, there's four choices of nucleotide to work with, four types of beads. And for DNA, there's four types of beads as well, but they're different because they have deoxyribose as their sugar. All right. I want you to compare the polynucleotide on the left with what we've already discussed about polypeptides. Remember that in polypeptides, the R group, which was the variable part of the amino acids, they were not at all involved in holding the string together. Right? It was the carboxyl and the amino part, which are non-variable. And then the R groups were just hanging off. Same is true here, except we're talking about, we use different words because they're not amino acids. These are nucleotides, but the only thing holding nucleotides together in a strand, in a polynucleotide, are covalent bonds between the sugar of one amino acid, of one nucleotide, and the phosphate of the next nucleotide. So sugar, phosphate, over and over. The nitrogenous bases, which are the variable parts, are not at all involved in holding it together, just like in a polypeptide. And by the way, what's holding this together, since it features bonds between sugars and phosphates, is collectively called the sugar-phosphate backbone. That's really important, by the way. These are covalent bonds, so they're strong, as you know, right? That's really important because this is an informational molecule we're talking about. DNA functions to carry information. What is the information? It's the specific sequence of A's, T's, C's, and G's. That's what the code is. And unless you save that code without scrambling it, the information is going to be lost. It would be lost, in other words, if these things were held together weakly and so that they could fall apart. Right? It would be like upending a Scrabble board. You just have a bunch of tiles. So these have to be strong bonds to hold the sequence together so that it is a permanent code. The variable part, just like in a polypeptide, hangs off of that backbone. The variable part is the nitrogenous bases in orange here. They don't hold it together, but they are what gives it its information, right? That is the variable part of it. That's what determines whether it's A, C, T, or G. All right, now, slide 30 shows you a picture of some of a DNA. Now, when I use the word A, or the phrase A DNA, singular, it implies that I'm talking about one molecule of DNA. It's really a single DNA is really two molecules, just like a single hemoglobin is four molecules, right? Because it's made out of four polypeptides. Each polypeptide is its own molecule. Similarly, DNA is a double-stranded nucleic acid. Two strands, but a strand here refers to a polynucleotide, an end-to-end arrangement of nucleotides. Each polynucleotide by itself is a complete molecule. DNA has two of those, though, and they're held together not by chemical bonds, but by non-chemical bonds, to package the whole thing together as what we call one DNA, even though it's two molecules. RNA, usually, there's a lot of different kinds of RNA, but typically RNA is a single strand, so it's just one polynucleotide. DNA is two. And we can see how DNA is arranged here. The blue, dark blue, and light blue ribbons here refer to the sugar phosphate backbone. But the light blue is one polynucleotide, and the dark blue is the other polynucleotide. And each single strand is helical, or corkscrew-shaped. But there's two of them, and that's why we call a DNA a double helix. There's two corkscrews. Now, hanging off of the sugar phosphate backbone at each position is some nitrogenous base, A, C, T, or G. And notice that at each position, there is a nitrogenous base hanging off of one strand and a nitrogenous base at the same position hanging off of the other strand. And they are held together by what is represented by these black ellipses, which represent hydrogen bonds. Very weak, as you know, right? Well, that's important. Just as it's important for the sugar phosphate backbone to have strong bonds so you don't lose the code, so it holds together, it's also important for the force holding the two strands together to be weak, which hydrogen bonds are. Because to use this DNA molecule, to read it and use the code, you have to temporarily separate the two strands and read one strand. You can't do that while they're together. So it's important for them to be separable, which hydrogen bonds are because they're weak. Each individual hydrogen bond is very weak, but there are millions of them because these are long molecules, these strands. And so they hold the two strands together nicely until the cell forces them apart. And when it's done reading, they'll go right back together nicely to hydrogen bond again. One thing that I haven't mentioned that was actually shown in the previous slide as well, but is shown here too, is that any individual polynucleotide, there's two of them here because it's double-stranded, but each individual polynucleotide is polar in the sense that there are two different ends, a so-called 3' end and a so-called 5' end. Let me go back to the previous slide because this shows it better. Notice that this is just one strand on the left here, this polynucleotide. It has a 3' end and a 5' end. And they're called that because of which carbon is involved. This is carbon 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. So this yellow thing, what does this yellow thing represent, by the way?
Phosphate
group. That's connected at the 5' end. The other end has an OH on it, a hydroxyl, which is connected to this third carbon. So that's the 3' end. But even, it doesn't matter how long it is, even a single nucleotide has a 3' end and a 5' end. Okay, so that's the polarity. Well, when it comes time to making, complexing two polynucleotides of DNA together to form one DNA, one double strand, the two strands are put together not 3' end to 3' end, but 3' to 5', like this. And that's called an anti-parallel arrangement. All right, well, we're going to study DNA in a lot more detail because after exam three, the whole rest of the term is going to be about DNA in one way or another. So we'll revisit these terms, but this is just an introduction to how this nucleic acid is built. And 31 is a slide, of course, but this is all stuff that I've already talked about. Some of these chapters have an ending summary slide like this, or maybe even two slides that summarize in a table the whole chapter. Well, I don't read those to you because I've already taught you this, but I do include them if they're there in the slideshow just in case you want to use them to study with. So don't think it's not important information, but it's stuff we've already talked about. Yeah, go ahead.
So if DNA, like all the nucleotides are polar, does that mean in RNA that there's the polar but it's not forming on each other?
Well, yes, but by polar here, I don't mean anything about charge.
Okay.
I just mean that 3' is different from 5'.
Okay.
So there's two different ends. And that's true for an RNA for the same exact reason, because it's made of nucleotides as well. They're just different versions of nucleotides. And the anti-parallel word just doesn't apply to most RNA because most RNA is just one strand. But there's still going to, for that one strand, be a 3' end and a 5' end. Any other questions before I stop the recording? Then we might as well repair to the laboratory.